When President Bush was making his case for invading Iraq, there was one overriding aim: to stop terrorists getting weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein.
The danger is clear. Using chemical, biological, or one day nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq, the terrorists could fulfill their stated ambitions and kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other.
This danger of states with weapons of mass destruction and terrorists getting their hands on them is a real one. But while Iraq was an unlikely threat on both counts, the real threat was ignored. Pakistan already has a nuclear bomb, and as we'll reveal, Saudi Arabia was largely responsible for financing it.
They needed assistance, and they got some of the assistance from the Saudis. Now the question is, what was the motivation of the Saudis in providing such assistance?
Tonight we investigate the sinister connections behind Pakistan's nuclear black market, the nuclear ambitions of Saudi Arabia, and their links to terrorists.
Where you have Saudi interests and Pakistani interests and Al-Qaeda interests converging, it's a very frightening picture.
By failing to act on clear evidence of nuclear proliferation in the Islamic world, has the United States facilitated the real nightmare scenario?
We're now talking about nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists. And it's very hard to imagine a greater nightmare than that.
As the main gateway to Afghanistan, the Pakistani city of Peshawar is an obvious place to look for the leakage of nuclear material to terrorists. During the 80s, it was a haven for Islamic jihadis and fundamentalist zealots, as well as a field headquarters for the CIA. When the CIA left, Taliban and their supporters swelled the city's transient population, and the first whisperings of the Al-Qaeda organization were heard.
We have heard the story that Al-Qaeda has been interested in acquiring some kind of, say, nuclear or biochemical technology. And there have been these small bits of information about meetings, say, between the Pakistani nuclear scientist and Mr. bin Laden.
It was in the late 90s that the first rumors of Pakistani scientists meeting with Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan were reported. But few journalists were able to establish Osama bin Laden's true motives. One who got close was the respected BBC correspondent Rahimullah Yousafzai.
When I met Mr. Osama bin Laden in 1998, I met him twice. In May in Khost, in his camp, which was then attacked by the US. And then I met him in December 1998 near Kandahar. And on both occasions, I remember him telling me that, look, according to the Holy Quran and the sayings of the Holy Prophet, the Muslims must upgrade their defenses. They must be ready to meet any challenge by their enemies.
Bin Laden had experience in meeting any challenge by his enemies. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, Bin Laden received hundreds of millions of dollars in arms and equipment from both America and Saudi Arabia to fight them. The irony of this is lost on few people today. But in the same way that that relationship helped spawn the world's most wanted terrorist, US support for the Afghan Mujahideen indirectly boosted Pakistan's bomb program.
The way these things work on a lower level, on a field level, on an intelligence level, is those niceties, those discussions about policy don't take place. And so the CIA station chief, the junior people on the ground, the people working with the money handling, the Saudis and the agency and others, wouldn't even think about those niceties. I mean, it's clear now that some of the same accounts that were used to fund the Mujahideen also funded the nuclear weapons program in Pakistan. Now, we made a deal with the devil. The devil was Pakistan. They wanted nuclear weapons. We wanted to defeat a bigger devil, the Soviet Union. So the deal is, they want to develop the weapons. We want to defeat the Soviets. In order to do that, we made a trade-off. Look the other way, otherwise it's not going to happen.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the whole region was in turmoil. The day after the Soviets invaded, Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, penned this memorandum to the president. Under the heading, What is to be done?, Brzezinski said it was essential to get Pakistan's support for the Mujahideen.
This will require a review of our policy towards Pakistan, more guarantees to it, more arms aid, and, alas, a decision that our security policy towards Pakistan cannot be dictated by our non-proliferation policy.
It appears the new policy was accepted. Billions of dollars flowed into the Afghan resistance, and there was no real effort to close down Pakistan's nuclear program.
There was an election here, and the Reagan administration came in at the beginning of 1981, not too long after the Soviet invasion had occurred, and they were totally focused on doing something about the Soviets in Afghanistan. And therefore, the question of Pakistan's bomb became secondary. So the United States foreign policy shifted from a focus on proliferation or non-proliferation to a focus on doing something about the Soviets in Afghanistan. So in what happened was that for the next 10 years, more or less, we provided assistance to the Mujahideen through Pakistan. We needed the Pakistanis in order to be able to deliver arms and other assistance. But the Pakistanis understood that if that was what the United States really wanted, that they could proceed with the development of the bomb and that we would turn a blind eye toward that process, which we did.
The ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency, was the favored conduit, and literally hundreds of suitcases stuffed with cash were given to them by both the CIA and Saudi intelligence. CIA sources suspected up to half the funding for the Afghan resistance ended up being diverted to help make Pakistan's nuclear bomb. But with so much cash flying about, the money trails were impossible to trace.
People who had no accountability, former intelligence people, people who'd been fired from the CIA, these guys were all in the mix in terms of running these operations. Well, you're not likely to get a whole lot of truth and honesty out of them. And if you give somebody $10 million in cash and say, go do this, well, he may do it, but there may be $3 or $4 million that disappears in the process. The CIA had no way, nor did Congress, of double-checking any of this.
Well, we were working together. Saudi Arabia was funding one half of the entire budget during the Afghan Jihad days. One half came from America and one half from Saudi Arabia.
Did they also help out on the nuclear funding?
Not to my knowledge. I have no... As far as nuclear field is concerned, I said it was not my business. So I don't know, have any information.
Retired General Hamid Gul was head of the ISI at the time the rivers of cash were flowing in, although he admits that there were American suspicions about diverted money to the nuclear program, no evidence was found.
And at that time, they made our government look into the accounts, and everything possible was done. But they did not find, not a single bullet, not a single dollar was misappropriated. I'm very proud to say that.
But outside of the ISI money trail, There was another method of financing Pakistan's nuclear program. The BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was the first global bank for the Islamic world. Founded by a Pakistani and funded by Arab Gulf states, it was used by criminals, governments and intelligence agencies to fund activities they wanted to hide. But the bank's illegal activities began attracting attention, and when BCCI collapsed in 1991, its books were thrown open.
But the paperwork was filled with fraud, riddled with fraud. Completely, totally unreliable, untrustworthy, and often untrue.
Jonathan Weiner was part of a US congressional inquiry led by Senator John Kerry, which began probing BCCI's criminal activities in the early 90s. It became clear that the BCCI trail led directly to Pakistan's nuclear program.
What we knew at the time is that BCCI officials believed that BCCI had been used for Pakistan's nuclear program to handle the funds. We knew that BCCI officials believed that the bank had been used by British intelligence, by US intelligence. We documented its use by certain terrorists.
It was here, through the BCCI's former London headquarters, that much of the external financing for Pakistan's nuclear program was channeled. Although we can't reveal his identity, Dateline has spoken to a former executive manager of the bank who's confirmed the links between BCCI and Pakistan's nuclear quest. According to the source, the bank was not only used to process payments for nuclear spare parts from Europe, but also secretly contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to help Pakistan develop the atomic bomb. According to the source, who would not appear on camera, 2 years before the bank's collapse, key executives querying a $400 million loss on a cotton project in Egypt were told that the loss didn't exist, and were informed that one of the bank's Arab owners had directly contributed the $400 million to Pakistan's nuclear development. What is disturbing about BCCI is that the links between the Saudi and Pakistan governments and terrorist networks were never investigated, and Jonathan Weiner believes they continued well into the 90s.
What's interesting is what happened to the BCCI people afterwards, and did any of them continue to engage in the kinds of activities they engaged in for BCCI after the bank collapsed? Some of the underlying cast of characters in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, continue to turn up after the bank goes under.
Despite the evidence of extensive Saudi involvement in BCCI, former spymaster Prince Turki Al-Faisal denies the links.
Saudi Arabia never used BCCI in any transactions, whether financial or otherwise. It never had an office in Saudi Arabia. And when I was at the intelligence service there, we never used BCCI for any activity, covert or otherwise.
Prince Turki's denials may be disingenuous. His uncle, Kamal Adam, was a BCCI shareholder, and John Kerry's Senate investigation uncovered loans worth millions from a BCCI-controlled company directly to Prince Turki. But he refused to be drawn on the issue.
You do, however, know something about BCCI from the past, though, I'd imagine, from your time in intelligence.
Seems to be ancient history by now.
Almost a decade after BCCI collapsed, some of the family names linked to it turn up in the now well-established Khan nuclear network. The London agent for the network was an accountant called Abu Siddiqui. In May 1999, he was arrested by British Customs for exporting banned technology for the nuclear network. it was the first crack that could have exposed the details and the money trail of the underground nuclear trade.
There is a clear trail through bank receipts that it was being funded to some extent by Saudi money.
Mike Pilgrim has spent three decades working for US intelligence. He has inside knowledge that US intelligence agencies were monitoring Saudi involvement in the Khan proliferation network in the late 90s. It was in Malaysia, where Pilgrim was a security advisor for Kuala Lumpur's new airport, that he learnt that Malaysian intelligence was also well aware of the black market nuclear trade on their soil.
The Malaysians weren't really interested, even though they knew, obviously, the Saudi influence, and they had a pretty good idea, especially through Khan and his relationship with Pakistani ISI intelligence. They had a real good inkling of who the players were.
Among the central players in Malaysia was this man, B.S. Tahir, a Sri Lankan business partner of Khan and the Siddiqui's. He married into the highest circles of government and set up a factory producing centrifuges for enriching uranium for Dr. Khan and his clients. The Malaysians would eventually close the factory under pressure from the US. But at that time, the Malaysians seemed unconcerned that their country was being used as a base to support what was becoming an Islamic bomb.
They would not have been adverse to seeing Muslim countries hold nuclear capability. The Malaysian attitude was basically business is business. They will take care of their own internal security. If it doesn't affect their own internal security, business is business. And that's what the economy of Malaysia was built on at that time.
Tahir had very high-level connections. He even had the son of the Malaysian Prime Minister on one of his company boards. But it was his Saudi connections that were of interest to the Malaysians. They were worried that some of his funding may have come from radical or extremist sources.
The concern was, again, the influx of personnel and the influx of money from radical areas. You have to remember at that time that Mahathir was very concerned about Malaysia's swing toward the radical, if you will, left at that point in time, through radical Islam. That was his major concern, not the technologies or where it might be ending up.
September 11th firmly planted Islamic fundamentalism on the world's agenda, many expected the United States to act decisively on the growing Islamic nuclear network. US intelligence had been monitoring Pakistan's nuclear proliferation for years. They knew about the Saudi involvement and the connections from Tahir in Malaysia through to Siddiqui in Britain. But incredibly, virtually nothing happened. In London, just weeks after the terrorist attacks, although Abu Siddiqui had been convicted of transferring banned nuclear technology, he was given a suspended sentence. To Mike Pilgrim, it was more like a slap on the wrist than the expected crackdown.
The slap on the wrist for the technology transfer seemed to be a lot more about not angering and really to lowball the Pakistani involvement in this entire process and the fact of Pakistani proliferation because of the need for allies in that part of the world, especially with Afghanistan going on and the problems we had there and the need for an ally in Pakistan.
When news of Dr. Khan's Islamic nuclear network became public earlier this year, Pakistan had already become America's key ally in the war on terror. President Bush accepted the Pakistani government line. It was all Dr. Khan's fault, and the network had been closed down. According to Leonard Weiss, this is dangerously short-sighted.
I think we are now in a very dangerous situation because the network is still out there. The materials and the equipment is out there, and it is only a matter of time, it seems to me, before some terrorist group gets hold of some of this.
To allow Pakistan and Saudi Arabia access to nuclear material seems particularly foolhardy. Despite both governments' friendly relations with the United States, their deeply Muslim populations see America as waging war on Islam. Fundamentalist political parties in Pakistan have a mindset that is ominously close to that of Osama bin Laden.
The religious parties in Pakistan, they call it great pride, an Islamic bomb. They say that this is a bomb that should be used for the defense of the entire Muslim Ummah, for the collective defense of Islam everywhere.
Professor Pervez Hoodboy is a Pakistani nuclear physicist who has spoken out against his country's proliferation abroad. He believes the situation in Pakistan is dangerously unstable.
There is a lot of hatred for the United States, especially after what it has done in Iraq and what it is continuing to do in Israel. I fear that if Musharraf is assassinated, that there could be a dangerous situation in the country and that the nuclear weapons then would possibly be hijacked.
The glue that holds the Pakistan-US alliance together is President Musharraf himself.
I felt the explosion in my car.
And he has already narrowly escaped two assassination attempts. Senior figures in Pakistan think it's time to re-evaluate the relationship with America.
Carrot and stick policy. Condoleezza Rice only a couple of days back in her testimony, she said we are using carrot and stick policy towards Pakistan. What a policy it is. From 1956 onwards, we have been their allies. What is it that we have not done for America? We are the ones who were responsible for stopping Soviet Union in Afghanistan, for making it reverse, and this Soviet Union disintegrated. Their biggest enemy was gone. And then lately we have done what we have done to Afghanistan and to Taliban. They were no enemy of ours, but we have done that. The head of the army cannot be promoted until Americans give the approval nod. So what is it that Pakistan has not done? And yet they are not satisfied with us. It only shows that it is very dangerous to be friends of America. Sometimes it's good to be their enemy.
By turning a blind eye to Pakistan's bomb and the efforts to set up a worldwide Islamic nuclear network, has America seriously misread the real threat?
The American government supported bin Laden, only to find him to be the greatest risk to our national security years later. The government supported the likes of Pakistan now. Are we going to be at war 2 months, 5 years from now with Pakistan?
Could short-term strategic expediency have blinded them to what could turn out to be the ultimate case of blowback?